101 is a slang term for the most basic knowledge in some subject.
101, like our podcast.
This is Venezuela 101.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Venezuela 101. I am Miguel Pizarro.
And I am Melanio Escobar.
In this podcast, we will interview different experts to discuss the main aspects of the political, economical, and social situation in Venezuela with the intention of having a broader and deeper understanding of the crisis that our country is going through.
Before today's topic and our guest, we want to remind you that if this is your first time listening to this podcast, you can find our previous episodes and the trailer through this same platform, where you will learn the main subject we address in this podcast and what drives us to create and maintain this space.
Well, to get into the matter, today in Venezuela 101, we wanted to talk about the Venezuelan exodus, the displacements of the Venezuelan population, which has increased exponentially in the recent years, and that affected not only the region, but is having huge repercussions on the entire hemisphere. Thousands of Venezuelans cross borders every day, most of the times risking their lives to flee Venezuela in search of better opportunities.
In fact, according to figures from the Response for Venezuelans platform, until May of 2022, there were already more than 6 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants in the world, of which more than 5 million are still in Latin America and the Caribbean. And to talk more about this, we are joined today by David Smolansky.
David served as Commissioner for the Secretary General of the Organization of American States for the Venezuelan Migrants and Refugees Crisis. He's a social communicator, former mayor of the municipality of El Hatillo in the state of Miranda, Venezuela, a position he held until he was a victim of persecution by the Maduro regime and he was forced to leave Venezuela. Thank you for joining us, David.
David, we would like to start with the basics, and that is that although we hear the term migration crisis frequently, and it is something that is mentioned in the news often, we would like to understand what it actually means. At what point does the displacement of a certain population become a crisis? What is the key indicator there? We would like to know the difference between a migrant and a refugee in the Venezuelan context.
Melanio and Miguel, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. It's an honor to be here, and congratulations for having this podcast. Well, this question is very important. The difference between a migrant and a refugee in the Venezuelan context. We have been saying since I started on this responsibility at the Organization of American States 4 years ago in 2018 that Venezuelans that have fled the country should be considered a refugee according to the Cartagena Declaration. Cartagena Declaration is the only document or agreement between countries that expand the concept of a refugee, and it says that a refugee is a person who flees a country because of general violence, human rights violations, foreign aggression, and public alteration. In our opinion, and we consider that those four determinants are going on right now in Venezuela. There's no question that in Venezuela there are human rights violations. There's no question that in Venezuela people are suffering from general violence. Let's not forget that Venezuela is still one of the most violent countries in the world, and Caracas is the most dangerous capital in the world, according to its homicides rate. And also there's no doubt that in Venezuela there is a public alteration when there's lack of food, lack of medicine, with lack of electricity, lack of water, and we presented that proposal in our very first report in 2019 during the General Assembly of the Organization of American States, with a report that I have to say was written by a panel of independent experts. And I think that the problem that we're facing is that the region has not made a consensus to recognize Venezuelans as a refugee. So we have, for example, Brazil. It's interesting, in Brazil, Venezuelans are considered refugees. Any Venezuelan, that lands to Brazil and want to become a refugee because of the situation that they are fleeing, they could request that. Brazil recognized Cartagena Declaration collectively, Mexico individually. But other countries have implemented their own mechanism to protect Venezuelan migrants and refugees. Probably Colombia is the one that is unique on the way that even though Venezuelans are not recognized as refugees automatically according to the Cartagena Declaration, they are implemented what they have called the Estatuto Temporal de Protección, which is like a TPS, let's say in the U.S., but for 10 years. So as I have always said, I mean, it's not temporary when you're talking about 10 years. So it's still a challenge because the longer Maduro stays, the more people are going to flee. Approximately 1,700 people are fleeing Venezuela daily. So in a basic math, that is a bit more than 50,000 people monthly. That's 600,000 people yearly. So this is a crisis that unfortunately is not stopping. It has already become the largest refugee crisis in the history of the region. Right now it's the second largest in the world behind Syria, with a projection to become the largest in the world maybe by the end of the year or by the beginning of 23. And this becomes a crisis. Migration becomes a crisis specifically in the case of Venezuela, when you have tens of thousands of people fleeing for different reasons. We have made a huge effort to understand to raise awareness for people to understand why Venezuelans flee their country. When there is an invasion, when it's a natural catastrophe, it's easier to explain why millions flee. In the case of Venezuela, there has not been a conventional war or natural catastrophe, but the migration flows are similar or even worse when you compare to nations that have been devastated by wars or by natural catastrophe.
Now, we know that this crisis has developed and increased over the last few years. But David, we want to know when exactly did this massive exodus begin and what, according to your opinion and experience, have been the trigger of it? Why do the people continue to risk their life to leave Venezuela right now?
Well, the massive exodus started in 2014. That's when the migration crisis started to be registered. There are some difference. There are some organizations that they come from 2015, but in any way, between 2014 and 2015 is when this crisis started, with important peaks in the year 2017, 2018, and 2019. In my office, we have registered almost 700 testimonies of Venezuelans that have fled. And we are talking of 700 refugees that are literally in almost every country in the region. We have spoken to Venezuelan migrants and refugees in the U.S., in Mexico, in Panama, in Costa Rica, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Chile, Bolivia, Uruguay. And there are five determinants why Venezuelans are fleeing. The first is the humanitarian crisis, or what is the technical name, the complex humanitarian emergency. According to the World Food Program on its report 2 years ago, 9.3 million Venezuelans are suffering from starvation. That means that 9.3 million Venezuelans cannot eat three times a day, which has become the largest population suffering from starvation on the Western Hemisphere and the fourth largest in the world. And when we have to add to that humanitarian crisis, the lack of medicine, the collapse of the healthcare in Venezuela, more specifically the public healthcare, right? The second is the human rights violations. There are thousands of testimonies of people that have fled, that they have been illegally detained, that they have been tortured, that they have been threatened, that they have been persecuted, that they have been repressed. I have to tell you, Melanio and Miguel, one of the things that we have registered the most is public servants that used to work, for example, in a local government of the regime, or they used to work in a ministry of the regime, and they were not they didn't have high responsibilities, but they were part of the bureaucracy, and sometimes they were told, for example, to authorize a bribe, literally authorize a bribe, or authorize an act of corruption, and those individuals they say no, that was not a good thing to do, of course, and they were automatically threatened, persecuted. We have cases of people that irregular armed groups were sent to their houses, that their children were kidnapped, so they had to flee. So human rights violations, systematically. That's the second, third general violence. I said it before. Venezuela is a very violent country. Since 1999, 377,000 Venezuelans have been killed. That's more than a lot of wars. So people don't feel safe. People flee. Then the lack of public services, more specifically access to electricity, water, internet, and that has become something more and more common during the last 2-3 years. People cannot tolerate to be a whole day or 36 hours with no electricity, with no water. We're talking a country that 7 out of 10 Venezuelans don't have electricity all the time, don't have access to water all the time, and that's something that is very complicated, especially if we're talking on houses that they have children. And then, of course, the collapse of the economy. So those have been the trigger. And as I said before, that's part of our mandate to raise awareness, not only on the governments, on the international community, but also on the societies. Because when you have an invasion like the one that is going on in Ukraine by Russia, it's easier to explain why millions flee. Or what has happened in Syria during the last decade, or when a country is suffering from a natural catastrophe, it's easier to explain why millions flee. And by the way, I'm not underestimating those events. It's horrible what's going on in Ukraine, what was going on in Syria, but it's easier to explain. So in the case of Venezuela, we have made a huge effort to have the international community understand why people are fleeing. And I think the main lesson is that the lack of freedom, the lack of democracy, the lack of rule of law could cause the same or even worse consequences on migration that nations that have been devastated by wars or by natural catastrophes.
What has been the response of the host countries and the international organizations to this situation? What are the measures that have been taken to date?
Before answering this question, I also wanted to add on the last one. I'm sorry if I'm taking a few more minutes. Is that you asked me, well, why do people continue to risk their life to leave Venezuela? Basically, because living in Venezuela for millions is also risking their lives. For many, many families, being in Venezuela is something about survival. So I always say that someone walks from Cúcuta in Colombia, which is the border with Venezuela, to Lima in Peru. That's the same distance if you walk in the U.S. from New York City in the East Coast to Salt Lake City, Utah, at the West Coast. Or it's the same that in Europe, walk from Spain to Finland. How desperate a human being needs to be to walk those distances. How bad a family needs to be to walk those distances. And those are the distances that Venezuelans have walked. Because when you don't have a bread to eat, or when you have your baby that is in danger because you cannot take her to a hospital, when you have your grandfather that doesn't find a medicine, and his life is in risk, well, you have to risk your life with a kind of guarantee that you could find those opportunities in other places that Venezuela is not providing because of the illegitimate regime. So with that, I'll go on the response of the host countries and international organizations. First of all, I think no one saw in the region that so many Venezuelans were about to flee. As we speak, there's 6.2 million Venezuelans. When we talk about that, is something that is difficult to put on the mention. It's more than the whole population of countries like Panama and Costa Rica, in the region. But if we go to other parts of the world, is bigger than the whole population of countries like Norway, Ireland, Kuwait, New Zealand. So it's a country out of the country, right? The region, as I spoke a little bit on the first question that you asked me, they have been response, like the examples that I provided from Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, also the United States of America with the TPS. Peru is implementing also what they call the Permiso Temporal de Permanencia, that now is Carnet Especial de Permanencia, CPP. Also, Ecuador is now doing a very interesting process of integrating Venezuelan migrants and refugees. Ecuador has 500,000 Venezuelans there. They are implementing a special visa for 2 years. Chile has implemented what they have called the Visa de Responsabilidad Democrática. So those have been the responses from the region. We also work with ministries of health and we launched 3 years ago a unique card of vaccination that was very important in the moment when the migration was at its peak. And there has been a donors conference since 2019. The first, by the way, was at the Organization of American States. I think that now the challenge is, and also I'm almost 3 million Venezuelans have been regularized. So 3 million Venezuelans have been integrated on their countries that they are. So on the challenges, I'm gonna speak on the next question. But that's what the region is doing. And in the case of the Organization of American States, Secretary General Luis Almagro created this special office to address this crisis in 2018. And with two specific mandates. One is to raise awareness, as I said, and second, to promote policies to protect, to integrate Venezuelan migrants and refugees. And that's what I have been doing. We have published 15 reports. We have visited 11 countries in the region. As I said, we have registered almost 700 testimonies, and we will keep doing that work because the world needs to know what Venezuelans are suffering, and also the world needs to do more to protect those that are victims of dictatorship.
Now, in terms of human rights organizations, including the Venezuelan civil society itself, what actions do you believe can be taken to alleviate the situation, to raise the awareness about the Venezuelan displacement, and also to increase the pressure over the regime?
I think that the Venezuelan civil society it's doing a lot with limitations, to be very clear. But it's admirable to see hundreds of NGOs that they are working 24/7 provide assistance to Venezuelans Venezuelan migrants and refugees. Actually, we did a report on the context of COVID-19 with the civil society, with a group its name is Coalición Venezuela, that they have been able to gather more than 60 organizations in more than 20 countries in the region. In that moment, on that report, we proposed different policies to governments of the region to assist Venezuelans on the context of COVID-19, which I have to say that even though when you are a refugee, of course, we are talking about a vulnerable person, and it becomes more vulnerable when there is COVID-19. But I think so many Venezuelans have been vaccinated, for example, against COVID-19 with no discrimination. So that's an example of coordination, right, that you can have between civil society and multilaterals like the OAS. But there are plenty of organizations that are working in literally every country in the region to provide different types of assistance, not only providing food or medicine, because sometimes people think, well, migrants and refugees, they need food and medicine. It's beyond that. It's beyond that. They need orientation, for example, on the country that they are arriving, right? Where they can live, where they can pray, where they can take their children to study. Also, it is important to provide conditions, opportunities to work, to get integrated to labor markets, which, of course, the role of governments is crucial because they are the ones that provide the documentation. Then, legal assistance, that's very important. You know, there are so many NGOs that are providing through legal firms pro bono assistance to those Venezuelans, migrants and refugees. And something that I think needs to be something that goes under the radar and it has to become literally a priority is its mental health assistance. I think there's no Venezuelan. There's no Venezuelan that after fleeing our country, they suffer from traumas that they had in Venezuela. If you were illegally detained, if you were tortured, if your mom was killed because of gangs, if you spend weeks and weeks with electricity for hours or water with hours, or if you were eating only once a day, that's, you know, you are devastated. And not to mention that you're fleeing the country that you were born, that you study, that you grow up, that you're separating from your families, because the vast majority of Venezuelans who have fled the country, they have been separated from their families. So, and then you have very risky migration routes like Darién, La Selva, El Darién, the Darién jungle in Panama, where more than 28,000 Venezuelans have gone through that jungle since January, and they have faced also on those routes horrible things. They have been robbed, women have been raped, they have been also threatened. So they are exhausted when you walk days, weeks, months to get to the U.S., for example. So they need assistance on psychologically. There are some NGOs that are doing that, which I really applaud those initiatives, but and I think that's not to be done. But, you know, there are limitations, and this is the crisis, migration crisis, that projects to be the largest in the world, but the most underfunded.
To conclude, I would like you to tell us, from your perspective and the role you play today, what comes next? How can we help? What more can be done by these organizations and the international community, even by the migrants and the refugees themselves, so that the migratory crisis does not become just a statistic or just being defined by being called the biggest crisis in the region?
Well, first of all, I would say that the longer Maduro stays, unfortunately, the more people are going to flee. I said it earlier, 1,700 Venezuelans are fleeing daily, and it doesn't seem that will change. And when I say this, it's because the region needs to be prepared that from 6.2 million we can get to 7 million by the end of the year or by the beginning of 2023. Of course, as any estimation, it could be wrong, it could be right, but a lot of estimations that we have made, if unfortunately has happened. And when I say unfortunately, because I could swear that those are the things that would like to be wrong, but the situation in Venezuela has not improved. I think the biggest challenge, or one of the main challenges that the region has, is that you have, I said before, that 3 million Venezuelans have been provided with documentation, so they are regular where they are. But you have at least 3.2 million Venezuelans that don't have documentation. So we're talking that a bit more of 50% of the Venezuelans who have fled still don't have a documentation. So they are in a very vulnerable situation. They don't have the documentation to work formally, to get integrated on labor markets. They have, even though access to healthcare and education is a human right, we know that when you don't have a documentation, you have bigger barriers to access to healthcare and education. You cannot do any routine diligence, like, for example, open a bank account or applying for a driving license or even applying for rent and an apartment. So I think the region needs to speed up the regularization of Venezuelan migrants and refugees. We need to get as soon as possible those 3.2 million integrated, because if you don't have documentation, you are vulnerable also to be unemployed, on informal economy, and in the case of many young Venezuelan migrants and refugees, to be vulnerable to be recruited, as it had happened to some, by illegal, by irregular armed groups, and women to be vulnerable to be victims of human trafficking. So definitely, we need to speed up the documentation, the regularization of those 3.2 Venezuelan migrants and refugees. We cannot be a statistic, and it's great that you are mentioning, we cannot become a statistic, a data. We if we don't share our story, no one will share it for us. If we don't describe, if we don't tell what we have been through, no one will do it. The world knew what happened to the Jews after 6 million Jews were exterminated at the Second World War, at the Holocaust, because they have been telling that for decades. We need to do the same. There are 6.2 million stories, literally, that are a terrible of what they have been through in Venezuela, what they have been through outside Venezuela. There have been also dramatic stories, but they have become a success stories, because I have seen so many Venezuelans being successful, working as an entrepreneur, working in a private company, working on the academic. So I agree with you that we cannot become a statistic, a data, but that needs to start from us, from Venezuelans. And I always say, don't be ashamed that you have fled your country. Don't be ashamed that you had to flee to help your family, to help those who are still in Venezuela, because those who are right now abroad, because we were forced to flee, we can be a voice. We can be the voice for the ones who are still in Venezuela. But the best way is to not be a data, to not be a statistic, is to share our stories. And I think more cooperation from the international community, as I said, on the funding, on specific programs. I was saying that earlier. Psychological assistance is crucial. There are so many Venezuelans that literally spend months of year or years to start again, and that's because they didn't have a psychological assistance when their journey began. And I think also we need to engage more with local governments to promote policies against xenophobia and discrimination. Sometimes I hear, well, you know, the policies against xenophobia and discrimination is a role from governments, federal governments, right, or from international organizations. No, the first authority that a migrant, you know, could go is a local authority, a mayor, or a council, women or men. So I think that those local governments could do more on promoting policies against discrimination, against xenophobia, which translate on policies of integration, which, by the way, Venezuela was a successful case decades ago.
Thank you, David, for your answers, for your time. Personally, I think that this is a topic that we can talk about for hours and hours, and we are never going to arrive to the end of it, because there are so many layers that can be addressed one by one. I would like to reinforce the relevance of the support of international community, of organizations, to like everything they are doing around the R4B platform and everything that is happening with civil society inside and outside of the country in order to continue providing care to the Venezuelan refugees and migrants. As you said, David, this is not a crisis caused by a war or a natural disaster, but this is a crisis built by political decision. This is a man-made crisis created by the Maduro regime, and that is also absolutely unprecedented in the region.
Thank you, David, for joining us and showing such a clear and first-hand picture of what the refugee and migrant crisis in Venezuela means. As you said, there are thousands of people who continue to cross the Venezuelan borders every day in search of opportunities, and even in search of respect for their basic rights, which are often taken for granted, the right to water, electricity, food, but that today in Venezuela are not guaranteed. David, you have all of our appreciation for the work you do.
Thank you, Melanio and Miguel, for inviting me, and I hope this is the first of many that we can speak about this very important issue for all Venezuelans and for the whole region. Thank you so much.
This was a new episode of Venezuela 101. If you like this podcast, share it. Spread the word with your colleagues, family, and friends. Follow us on our social media at Miguel_Pizarro, at Melanio Bar, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a comment. Please tune in again in 2 weeks with new guests on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Anchor FM, and YouTube.